I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, lordsofpain.net. Wherever you may be listening, Doc says.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast, Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment and of the doctor's orders on lordsofpain.net. Doc says. Hello and welcome to the Doc Says here on thechairshot.com. I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment, the greatest matches and rivalries of the WrestleMania era, and of the doctor's orders on lordsofpain.net. And wherever you may be listening, thank you for making me a part of your day. For those of you that are still kind of getting to know me since I debuted here on The Chair Shot a few weeks ago, I have a lot of different interests extracurricularly. One of them is professional basketball, and we're kind of in the heat of the NBA season, the NBA Finals. One of my favorite sporting times of the year. I get wrapped up in the storylines and the drama of professional basketball's peak, just as I do professional wrestlings. And what I wanted to do today was sort of blend the two passions together, and that's something you can get used to me doing throughout the course of the year. I like to intersperse when something big is going on outside of wrestling that I so thoroughly enjoy. I like to try to make connections between my other passions and my passion for pro wrestling, which is probably tops among my list of extracurriculars. Clearly, I would say the top among my extracurriculars. So today what I'm going to do is draw some parallels between some of the things that I was wrong about in professional basketball over the years that I have since been proven wrong about, and that I really appreciate that. I like it when I follow a narrative and I'm following the national narrative on a player or a team, and my opinion has changed organically over time. The same has happened in professional wrestling on numerous occasions over the years. And I'm kind of in that point in my pro wrestling fandom where, you know, WWE and the relationship I have with it is sort of strained in general. I mean, I still love it, just like I love professional basketball, but and I will always watch it when it's peaking. But at this point, professional wrestling at large is growing to a point where I don't have to necessarily follow the WWE to get what I want out of professional wrestling, whereas I don't think I'd be able to do the same with pro basketball and the NBA and things of that nature. So nevertheless, that being said, there are some cases I want to bring up of professional wrestlers specific to WWE who have really changed my mind over time, or there was a narrative about them that I bought into that eventually I came to reflect upon after they'd proven me wrong, and thought very highly of that, and thought very highly of that wrestler accordingly from a historical standpoint. And I love putting things together historically. That's something that really drove the passion for writing the books that I did, is I like to put this stuff into context. So I'm going to do a few of those today, and if you have any feedback for me, hit me up at the Doc LOP if you have some similar sports star type, particularly basketball, since we're on the topic, you know, anything in the NBA or college basketball narrative that that you enjoyed seeing erased organically over time by that player or team or wrestler in this case, as we transition to the wrestling part of the discussion, please let me know at the Doc LOP on Twitter. So let's start with the one that really inspired me to want to do this podcast, and that's the Golden State Warriors in the NBA. When they came about over the course of the earlier part of this decade, when Mark Jackson took over as the coach of the team and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson started to emerge as legitimate players in the league, and then when Steve Kerr then took over and the Warriors dynasty as we've known it came to be, initially I was skeptical of it. You know, I really enjoyed the narrative of LeBron James and the Miami Heat earlier in this decade. I thought that they did a good job of going from the enemy number one, and then sort of LeBron gaining back the love from fans in the league at large. I enjoyed that narrative, and then all of a sudden this Warriors team comes at a time when it looks like LeBron is really going to make his push and his challenge to Michael Jordan's NBA historical supremacy, and the Warriors come in and they really kind of stuff a big part of what could have helped fuel that fire, that being LeBron winning more championships. The Warriors have been in his way, and the bottom line is that without Steph Curry and the Warriors and all of the things that have happened, the signing of Kevin Durant, the two straight championships leading into this postseason, and everything that we've seen unfold in the postseason with the Warriors this year, it's just one of those things that at the time when it started in 2015, I was against it. I was rooting for other teams like Chris Paul's Los Angeles Clippers to rise up, meet them, and challenge them and actually take them down. I wanted to see the Warriors have to earn it, and they just kind of came out of nowhere. But I got to a point where they just were so great. They were so great by winning that first title that I do think they had some luck there with some injuries and flameouts of teams like Chris Paul's Clippers unexpectedly in the second round. The Warriors in 16, when they followed up that championship in 67 wins by resetting the NBA record for regular season wins. To me, that was a highly impressive thing. I don't know that I ever expected Michael Jordan's 96 Bulls team to have that record relinquished. I mean, 72-10 was the previous mark by Jordan's Bulls, and that was amazing. So Steph Curry's Warriors getting 73 wins, even though they didn't win the championship, actually, I think that helped my opinion of them. Initially, Durant's signing made me feel like they were that much more villainous. But in the last few years, what I've come to appreciate about the Warriors, both pre and post Durant, is Durant's signing, that is greatness. And greatness is something that in any walk of life, I think you should be able to find an appreciation for, because, you know, it may not be the most relatable thing in the world, but you'd obviously like it to be at some point in your life, something that you could relate to. Greatness on a consistent scale. So the Warriors changed my mind over time. And the first guy that came to mind for my WWE career as a fan was Kurt Angle. I remember back in the early part of the 2000s, I saw Kurt Angle for the first time when I tuned back in during about a year-long hiatus when I was in high school. And Kurt Angle debuted during that period. And when I came back, I felt very lukewarm about Kurt Angle. I felt very lukewarm about him defeating The Rock to win the WWE title. I felt very lukewarm about his return to prominence in the summer of 2001. But as time went on, as 2002 progressed, and he had those matches with Edge in the spring of that year, and then he had the matches with Rey Mysterio and Chris Benoit through the end of 2002 into early 2003, and then he gutted it out and had that great main event with Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 19. From that point forward, my thought process toward Kurt Angle changed, because what I began then appreciating was, much like with the Golden State Warriors and the NBA, I started to appreciate Kurt Angle's greatness. And from that point forward, I felt like Kurt Angle did something that very few in the history of WWE and professional wrestling at large has been able to do, and that is compete at such an incredibly high level that your expectation every time you saw him wrestle was greatness, especially on a big stage like a Royal Rumble, a SummerSlam, a WrestleMania. You expected those things of Kurt Angle. That peaked for me in that WrestleMania 21 match against Shawn Michaels, my all-time favorite wrestler, Shawn Michaels, going up against Kurt Angle, a guy whose absolute brilliance I had grown to greatly admire. You put those two elements together, what do you get? To me, still one of the top 15 to 20 matches in the history of WWE. And Kurt Angle, obviously we didn't get to see him close out his career in WWE, but some of the stuff that he did in TNA Impact Wrestling was great in its own right for several years. But the WWE run in particular to me for Kurt Angle was a real eye-opener. It changed my mind, and I loved the fact that I was wrong. The guy who introduced me to the internet wrestling community, a guy who became a good friend of mine, but who began as the three or four year older brother of my best friend in high school, and this guy is his name. We've always called him Matt Berg because he was a big Goldberg fan. He convinced me to get on and log online and discover places like LordsOfPain.net, which started my quote unquote, you know, secondary career in writing about wrestling, like I have been doing since 2004, and then sites like PW Torch, and then the emergence of all these other sites like the Chair Shot. It's been pretty cool to see. But anyway, he's the guy who introduced me to it, and he likes to bring up when we talk about Kurt Angle that as he helped me get back into wrestling in late 2000, early 2001, Kurt Angle was a guy who I just said all he can do is punch, and he threw a great worked punch. But then later he got down to business, and I gained a great appreciation for the technical aspects of his game. I gained a great appreciation for some of the little things that he did, things like the near fall pin and the near fall submit. To me, Kurt Angle did that better than anybody. His ability to get his shoulder up at just the last second, and his ability to make you think with his hand inches off the mat that he might tap out in a move like the Crippler crossface or something to that degree. So Kurt Angle, just a brilliant wrestler, someone who I've always admired since. And, you know, always, to me, those are the types, when you get guys like that, and they eventually end up doing their WWE Hall of Fame speeches, that's what makes the Hall of Fame, to me, special, is guys like Kurt Angle, who you came around to admiring because of their greatness, and then seeing them be able to end their career on a high note in that Hall of Fame-like setting. I know he had some matches thereafter, but, you know, that's not going to be the angle I remember. I'm going to remember the angle who tore the house down with guys like Undertaker, with guys like Steve Austin, particularly guys like The Rock, Shawn Michaels, Chris Benoit, Edge. And I'm going to think very fondly of that. And that Hall of Fame speech he did a few years ago was that much more special accordingly for me. The next comparison I want to draw is between The Miz and Dirk Nowitzki. Dirk Nowitzki retired this year after a lengthy career that dates back to the infancy of my diehard NBA fandom. I think he was drafted in 1998, which is a draft I remember very, very well for being in Orlando in a year where the Magic had three late lottery, early first round non-lottery picks. And interesting story there. Back then, they had this little shop in downtown Orlando in the shape of the Orlando Arena, the O-Rena, as they called it back then. And I went to that place the day after the draft. I was never a bigger Orlando Magic fan than I was at that point. Penny Hardaway was my favorite player of all time back when I was a kid. He still might be. I don't think any player has ever really usurped what he meant to my early basketball fandom. But my dad and I, he lived in Orlando at the time, we went to the Fanatic the day after the draft, and guess who was there at the time that we were there? They had flown the draft picks from the previous night, I guess from New York. I don't recall if they would have done the draft in any other location. It's usually in New York, so they put it in New York, and they brought the draft picks in the next day to the Fanatic at the exact same time that I was there. So Matt Harpering, Michael Doliak, Keon Clark, and Miles Simon, one of the big players on the Arizona National Championship team in 1997. So I got to meet all of those guys, and that later at that point, my dad, I'm buying all this stuff with my allowance. I've got this clock that I loved. I'd hoop with it after school every day, pretty much all through high school, dating back to right when I left for college. But I've got this little Orlando Magic Fanatic thing, and it's a clock with the Magic logo on it and a little hoop on it and a little ball so you can, you know, do like all the dunks that you want. I loved that clock. So I noticed that my total is about $30 less than I think it should be, that I've added up in my head to match my allowance amount I was allotting for this. My dad notices it too. I'm about to say something. I look up at him and he just shakes his head, gives me this little, nope, don't say anything. So I got a free clock. Looking back on it, that probably wasn't the best thing to do, but nevertheless, I've always enjoyed that story. Anyway, so That draft is the draft that Dirk Nowitzki enters the NBA. And it was very interesting because you didn't know what to expect from the guy. He comes from a background in Germany that, isn't exactly a basketball player producing powerhouse. And here comes this 7-foot guy who can shoot the lights out, drive to the hoop, big guy, has a lot of the labels that European players had back then. But he gets to the NBA Finals in 2006, and you're thinking, man, this guy has arrived. This guy is going to change the way that we view European players. He's going to do an amazing thing. It's going to be awesome, and he makes it to the Finals. And then you have that series against the Miami Heat with Dwayne Wade taking over and really willing the Heat to their first NBA title. And Dirk Nowitzki fades to the background for several years. The following year, they win 67 games in Dallas. But then he flames out in the first round of the playoffs on the number one seeded team, the team favored to win the title. And I look over at The Miz in WWE, and I see this guy who's coming from such an odd background in his own right. He's coming from a reality television show, and he's got the passion, and he's got charisma, and we know that. But, the narrative becomes that this guy is the drizzling you-know-whats, and he's always going to be that. But then all of a sudden, he starts to slowly but surely get better. And in the latter part of last decade, he gets to a level where, as a talker, he's blowing you away with some of the things that he can say, with the passion and charisma and intensity that he's saying these things with. And he main events WrestleMania 27. He wins Money in the Bank the previous year. He's in one of the feuds of the year with Daniel Bryan, leading up to their match for the U.S. title, that Night of Champions 2010. And then he main events against John Cena with The Rock in the background. And you're thinking, wow, this guy may very well have arrived. But John Cena and The Miz have a critically derided match. And The Miz pretty quickly, at that point, starts to get classically Cena'd. And in my vocabulary, being Cena'd is being defeated in such ways that makes your career post-John Cena far lesser than what it could have been and looked like it might have been leading up to feuding with him. It's one of the biggest knocks on John Cena's legacy, according to many, and it's one that I think is difficult to get away from, no matter how you feel. As positive as that might be, as I generally tend to be, about John Cena's career and legacy. But The Miz, that following year, much like Dirk did in the NBA in 2007, ends up in 2011 having a very respectable year. He's in a lot of the headlining matches. He closes out the year strong, coming back to the main event after a several-month absence post-WrestleMania season and its aftermath. He loses the title to John Cena, gets back in the hunt toward the end of the year. That following WrestleMania season, though, very much the equivalent of Dirk's 2007 NBA playoffs. The Miz is in a 14-man match, tag match, that's pretty much an afterthought involving Johnny Laurinaitis, and from that point forward basically disappears for the next 5 years. He does not show up, much like Dirk, does not return to prominence when it matters until the 2011 NBA playoffs, where a few breaks go Dallas's way, and they end up willing themselves on Dirk's back to a championship over the Miami Heat, when the Miami Heat were certainly, undeniably, the enemy number one in the NBA. They take down the top heel, does the Dallas Mavericks with their babyface run to the 2011 title. The Miz in 2016, 5 years after his peak ended as well, somehow manages to get all the way to back to prominence and respect and a level where people, by the time we're done with 2017, The Miz is being legitimately talked about as one of the top 50 WrestleMania-era stars, something that just did not seem possible even a year prior to that run that he had, leading up to the end of 2016, where he engages Daniel Bryan on Talking Smack, where he has these amazing matches over the Intercontinental Championship with Dolph Ziggler, where he continues that run as being the face of the Intercontinental title division during a time where the title is in a resurgent state. The Miz changed his career dynamic. He changed his legacy. He's now regarded very well. He's a future Hall of Famer. In my book, In the last draft I did, it came out about a month prior to The Miz going on his unprecedented, his absolutely fantastic late 2016 run that's fed into the rest of his WWE career to date. And in that book, I openly questioned, and I need to go back. This would be one of the reasons why I might someday revisit the WrestleMania era, the Book of Sports Entertainment, which ranks the greatest 90 wrestlers of the WrestleMania era into three tiers, just like Bill Simmons did with his Book of Basketball back in about 2010 was the last edition he did, ranks the top 90 or so players in NBA lore. I did the same with pro wrestling and WWE and the WrestleMania era specifically. But I said about The Miz, he'll strike you in the end as a poor man's Chris Jericho, and that's how we'll remember him. Maybe we still remember him that way, but at the time, it was intended to be a slight dig at what I thought The Miz might be and then never actually became. And then he turns around a month later and begins the run that ends up really, I think, defining now the legacy that he has achieved. And The Miz, I mean, that's awesome. That's the kind of stuff in this day and age where you're hoping that WWE answers the call, gets better, does things creatively in a better way, and starts to win back some of the fans that it has lost over the years with some of the decisions that it has made from a show quality standpoint. And you hope that you're proven wrong when you say that, man, it just doesn't seem like it's going to get any better. You hope the WWE responds. Even if you think they're doing quite well, you want to see them excel and be at their best. Can they in this modern era, when you wonder what's motivating them to possibly do that? I love the fact that The Miz and Dirk Nowitzki, much like Angle and the Warriors, proved me wrong, made me think twice, and now I regard things that I used to think and hold as gospel as something completely different. That's always a cool thing as a fan of any sport or entertainment avenue. What does it look like when someone who you think is going to be remembered one way changes their narrative to make you regard them a different way? Changing the tone a little bit, we've talked about, you know, a team and a wrestler who you ended up appreciating because they were great. You talk about a team and a wrestler who changes, or a basketball player and a wrestler who changes the narrative about their career, and they end up being greater than people sort of thought that they were going to be. They'd been written off, and they came back and achieved the greatness that once had been expected of them. Now let's talk about a situation in Houston right now, where the Houston Rockets have two players who basically they've underachieved. They've not achieved that which many thought that they could. Chris Paul, you know, I have a lot of history with Chris Paul. We're a year apart in age, and he went to we grew up in the same county. I grew up on the east side of it. He grew up on the west side of it. So our county, that's what our high schools were named after. He went to west. I went to east. So we had some pretty good basketball players that came through our pipeline as well. And so some great basketball games in high school. I saw, you know, really right in front and center, the emergence of Chris Paul into the mainstream consciousness. And I'll never forget, you know, watching the SportsCenter highlight of his senior year. I'm a year older than he is. So watching his senior year highlight, that game where he scored 64 points after his grandfather was killed. I mean, that stuff, I've got a history with Chris Paul. He goes to Wake Forest, which is 15 miles from my house. I mean, it's in the county in which we grew up. And Chris Paul ends up going to the NBA, and by the end of last decade, early part of this decade, people are talking about him as being an evolutionary Isaiah Thomas and a guy who has actually become arguably the greatest point guard of all time. And that's weird. They call him the point god. But when it came to success, it just never really happened for him. It didn't really happen for him in college. You know, I don't think Wake Forest even made it out of the second round in the 2 years that he was there in the NCAA tournament, as opposed to like a Steph Curry, who is one of the all-time NCAA tournament legends for his run in 2008. And then a guy like, and then he comes to the NBA, and the Hornets never quite get there when he's in New Orleans, and the Clippers never quite get there when he's in Los Angeles, and now he's in Houston, and they've just still not quite gotten there. You know, opportunity knocks this year, and they just couldn't answer the bell. And then his teammate James Harden, it's kind of been the same thing. You know, he comes in and builds this legacy for himself and emerges as an MVP candidate very quickly after getting traded to the Houston Rockets. And you think, wow, okay, I mean, this is a guy who, you know, he's an MVP. He's an MVP candidate for three straight years, winning it in 2018, runner-up for it in 2017. As of this recording, the likely runner-up again. So we're talking about one of the top five players in the league over the past few years. But the playoff success has not been there, and there's been some pretty epic flameouts in the playoffs. And I look at those two guys, and I look at the Rockets in particular over the last few years, while this Warriors juggernaut's been mowing through the Western Conference, and I actually think of Dean Ambrose, who we talked about on the show last week. Dean Ambrose, to me, is a guy who I always figured would follow in the footsteps of the Rollins and Reigns brethren from the Shield, and he would get all the way to the top. He would be a consistent top five guy in WWE. He would be main eventing SummerSlam. He'd be in the running to main event WrestleMania, which is arguably as difficult to do now as it's ever been before, despite the fact that obviously we've seen something unprecedented at WrestleMania 35 with the women main eventing. But I mean, it's just been one of those scenarios with Ambrose in WWE, or was, I guess, that Ambrose comes into this scenario as a guy who seems like he's a lock for one of those spots. Like back in the day, the guy I've always compared him to, the guy whose real footsteps I thought he would follow in historically, was Edge, who I've labeled the St. Louis Cardinals of WWE lore, because he's got the same kind of title record and the track record and the accolades, and he's got this incredible resume historically, and he's kind of on par in that regard with teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox, etc. But people don't regard him that way for whatever reason. Maybe it's because he's never been asked to carry the franchise. I mean, the Cardinals are never going to be one of those teams that carries Major League Baseball when you've got teams like the Yankees and Red Sox out there. Edge was kind of the same in WWE, and I thought Ambrose would rise to that, but I don't think he ever got there, frankly. And, you know, at this point, it doesn't look like he ever will, though he's still very young and he could come back and he could end up getting to that spot. He could reach that pinnacle and become that. Obviously, we've seen in examples like with Ambrose, you can do it. But the fact of the matter is Ambrose has never gotten there. This is a guy who was left off of a couple of WrestleManias in his prime when you would have expected him to be in one of the prominent matches. This is a guy whose biggest opportunity at WrestleMania came and went with a thud, critically, the match with Brock Lesnar, and it may not have been his fault, but nevertheless, his name is still historically attached to it. So I look at Chris Paul, and I look at James Harden, and I see them as being very comparable to Dean Ambrose, and I think Dean Ambrose is going to be one of those guys who we'll look back at one day, and we'll have these big historical discussions, and we'll be talking about top 50 level guys. And, you know, people who were around for the early WrestleMania era will bring up someone like Sergeant Slaughter and say, well, hey, this guy main evented WrestleMania 7. It was one of the most notorious angles in the history of the business. And then you talk about Dean Ambrose, and you're like, well, what did Dean Ambrose do on that kind of a level? Did he do anything on that kind of a level? And what's your response going to be if you're a Dean Ambrose fan and you want to really kind of root for the positioning of your guy? I think you're going to struggle. I think you're going to struggle when you start to try to advance him up the list. He's going to run into a wall of guys like Sergeant Slaughter, of guys like Mr. Perfect and Scott Hall, who even though they did not win that elusive world championship that so many bring up when discussing their place in history, well, Dean Ambrose was only the champion once, and it was for a fairly forgettable run. To be frank, I mean, he won the title via Money in the Bank, and 3 months later, AJ Styles was dethroning him. And though that was the best stretch run of Ambrose's career in my mind, the point when, outside of the Rollins feud in 2014 and 15, that was the best stretch he'd ever had. But that's not necessarily the narrative about Dean Ambrose. And I sit here and I wonder to myself, do I buy the narrative about Dean Ambrose? Do I buy that narrative that he's not one of the top 40 wrestlers of all time, that guys like Jeff Hardy, that guys like Booker T, that even guys like Jeff Jarrett aren't ahead of him in the pecking order? Because quite frankly, the moment never really came for Ambrose where he reached the pinnacle. He is James Harden in WWE history, in my opinion. I'll do a couple of rapid-fire ones, and then I'll go ahead and get out of here and let you guys bring me your comments about which ones you feel reflect your own feelings in WWE history, relating them to things beyond WWE lore. One of them for me that I really like here lately is Becky Lynch. I always liked Becky Lynch, much like I always really liked Giannis when he came into the NBA. I'm a big fan of the Bill Simmons podcast, and he would regularly talk about just how much he enjoyed the infectious enthusiasm of Giannis. He's from Greece, plays for the Milwaukee Bucks, and I mean, this guy basically, I mean, you've seen what he's done in this year's playoffs. It's been amazing. But, you know, he comes in from Greece and he's learning English and learning being in the United States, and he's just having a blast with simple American things, like food, for instance. Or just he'd do tweets. He was one of the best guys to follow on Twitter because he was just so excited about certain little things. And then here you have Becky Lynch, who comes in to the WWE, and she's just so likable. Dating back to her time in NXT, you can't help but like her. You can't help but be excited for her when she goes into the early part of 2016, has those matches with Charlotte for the SmackDown for the Divas title at that time, and then she works her way into that great match, really the uncrowned main event of WrestleMania 32 in the most attended WrestleMania of all time in Dallas. I was there in the building, and Becky Lynch is just so likable. You couldn't help but be excited for the fact that she got that spot, and she was the one who tapped out. She lost to give Charlotte the newly crowned women's title, but to see Becky Lynch kind of emerge slowly but surely, work her way up. Giannis sort of had a similar kind of path where it just, you know, he was steadily, you know, making progress, and you hoped that he would get a shot. You kind of wondered if he would ever get there. And then Becky Lynch explodes out of nowhere, much like Giannis has this past year, and blows you away with what she's able to accomplish, because I don't think anyone saw Becky Lynch coming, at least not to the point that she ended up, you know, getting to, all the way to the main event of WrestleMania. And here you got Giannis over in the NBA, who emerges with this Bucks team with a new coach who I think a lot of people thought would help them take the next step. But damn, you know, 60 wins and what they ended up accomplishing, that's pretty amazing. And Becky Lynch, same thing. I mean, to emerge out of nowhere almost at the exact same time of the year and, you know, get all the way to the main event of and winning the main event of WrestleMania, that's an amazing feat. That's one of the best, most modern, recent examples that I can recall of somebody just completely changing their narrative and me really, really appreciating it. It's not like I ever didn't hope that Becky would get to this spot. I always hoped she would because she's so damn likable. But I don't think I ever really thought she would get there. It just didn't seem like it was going to be possible for her to achieve what she's achieved. And that's one of those things you love to feel like that about. I felt that way about the heights that CM Punk reached in WWE, and I felt that way about what Daniel Bryan was able to accomplish. Now, the other one I want to bring up before signing off is John Cena. And I've looked at John Cena for many years now. I've written about it. I wrote about it in my greatest wrestlers book, the WrestleMania era, that I compared him to John to LeBron James in the NBA. I mean, they come about at roughly the same time, and they both sort of emerge as the faces of their respective games at the same time amidst a lot of criticism, a lot of early hype builds some real respect and some real fandom for both guys. But when they get to the top, they're met with a lot of controversy. They end up being very polarizing figures. And LeBron ends up making it through all the criticism, taking it on the chin, getting to the next level and the next level and the next level. And, you know, constantly flirts with being the most reviled guy, just as much as he flirts with being one of the most well-liked players of all time and most respected. And John Cena sort of followed a similar path. He emerges from the rapper gimmick in the early 2000s, and changes his MO and sort of becomes this squeaky clean image guy, and he's great for it. I mean, he's great in that role, much like LeBron was great in his. And he ends up, he tells you what we're supposed to remember him for. You know, there's always going to be people who compare him to other guys. LeBron gets compared to Michael Jordan, and John Cena gets compared to The Rock. And you could make the argument that Jordan and The Rock are the greatest of all time in their respective professions. And these are two of the guys who are most frequently compared to them. And I've been very fond of the fact that I've been able to watch John Cena's career unfold through every level. And now seeing both guys on the back end almost about to fade fade away from the limelight, and fade into the background and, you know, not walking off into the sunset just yet. Both guys are young enough to be able to do quite a bit more in their respective fields. But my goodness, you know, I feel very privileged to have been able to watch the entire LeBron James era unfold in the NBA. And I feel the same way about John Cena emerging through WWE's ranks to end up in the position he has historically. I mean, he's done some pretty amazing things. He's been in these situations that really define him as one of the top five all-time stars in WWE by most measures. And that's an impressive thing to be able to say. Some would obviously dispute it, just like people are going to dispute many of the claims about LeBron. But I say, to what end? Because if you look at it rather objectively, and the term that I've used in my book that really should have patented that thing. I mean, that's basically my go-to saying. I'm not a fan of this idea that wrestling is totally subjective. So I created the term, certainly borrowed from an obscure source that I never actually found. It just kind of popped into my head. I always try to be impeccable with my words. So whoever invented the term objective subjectivism, then, you know, fair enough. But I've used that term for many, many years. And I think, quite frankly, being objectively subjective, looking at it from a very logical narrative, similar to like what you would see when you try to judge who are the top four teams in college football, when you've got this criteria that you're using to establish the ranking that you're doing, when we do that for professional wrestling greatness in terms of wrestlers themselves, John Cena, he checks every box, man. And because of that, from longevity to championships to the match performance record to the number of WrestleManias and SummerSlams and headline to the Royal Rumbles won to the business impact that he had to the role that he played in the rise of WrestleMania and the WWE brand to what they are, John Cena is one of the greatest of all time. And if you go and you look both objectively at LeBron's statistics and objectively subjective at what LeBron has accomplished overall, then it's difficult to dispute that he's one of the top five in NBA history. So it's a cool narrative, I think, looking back at John Cena and LBJ's careers and just kind of just being in awe of what you were privileged enough to be able to watch happen with your own two eyes at a time in your life when you could best appreciate it.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the Mania era is bringing terror on radio. This is the prepare for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast. Chat, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania